the title of this year's conference was Reformation 2.0, Luther Lit a Fuse, What Happens Next? The steering committee have brought together four people, three theologians and an activist. Sort of sounds like a movie title, doesn't it? Actually, it's probably more like our prophet, two theologians and an activist, really. But, and it's lovely to have Lloyd here again this morning here. And so the steering committee wanted to find a person who's been lighting fuses in the real world, taking on the establishment, pointing out corruption and unfairness in society right now. And this is at the heart of progressive spirituality. And we felt that there wasn't any person better in New Zealand at the current time than Sue Bradford, who we're so pleased accepted our invitation and accepted it with just wonderful grace. She said, I've never been to a group like this before, and when I told her that the average age of the Sea of Faith is pretty close to 80, she was excited by that. It's true. And she was very keen to come to the whole conference, be part of the conference, and really find out about us. And that's a wonderful thing when an outside person wants to have that engagement with us. And her vision of a transformed Aotearoa, I use the words, and some of, I know others have used the words, the coming of the kingdom of God on earth is very much, that's just another way of saying what Sue's going to talk to us about. And I do see, it was wonderful last year to have Greta Vosper come and talk us about what she's actually doing in progressive Christianity. And that, I see a continuity with the talk we're going to get now from Sue. So please welcome Sue to the stage.
Kia ora koutou. Thanks very much, Doug and the Sea of Faith Committee, for making me welcome here today. Kia ora, Lloyd, and everybody here. It certainly was a big surprise to be invited to this, and I had never heard of you, which seems a bit remiss, but that's how it was. So, on Doug's advice, this is what I'm going to talk to you about today. Just an introduction, a bit of my life story. I think one or two of you might have read that biography that's sitting over there, but I'm sure most of you have not. And then looking at that and some of the key things I've learnt from that life of fuse lighting, and then a bit of a look at where I see things going and posing a few questions to you. Here it seems everyone asks, what was your background in terms of church or Christianity in your life? I grew up in an atheist family. Totally atheist, but my father's family had been in Aotearoa since the 1820s and 1830s. My great-great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather were two of the first missionaries in the north, in Waimate North and in Kaitaia. I don't know if anyone here is related. You could well be. So on my father's side, out of the Anglican missionary background, my mother was American, came from Wisconsin, and brought. Her family had been Dutch Reform, and her reaction against religion was very much a reaction against that Dutch Calvinism. We were a left Labour family, really, so quite soft compared to where my politics ended up. I spent a year in America with my family when I was in 10th grade, went to school there, and why I've got the Fallout Shelter sign there is one of the political awakenings for me was going to high school in Wisconsin and having nuclear air raid shelters under the school where we had to go if the sirens went, and nuclear air raid sirens on the corner. It made nuclear war and the threat of it back in the 60s very, very real in a way that here in New Zealand, as children, we didn't feel at all. So that, and then at the same time, the Vietnam War was just heating up. Girls in my class had boyfriends that were going off to war. And again, it made it real in a way that you don't really feel here. So from that age of around 13 or 14, I was very political. These were some of the groups I was part of in the early part of my life. The Progressive Youth Movement from 1967 to 69, which was like the youth branch of the Communist Party. So the first politics I learnt was Marxism, Leninism, Maoism at the feet of the New Zealand Communist Party. But by 69, I'd rejected that kind of totalitarian communism. Started to be much more open to different ideas, different traditions. I was at university by then. I started university when I was 16. Went to my first lecture from Lloyd Gehring when I was 17. That's where I remember Lloyd. A chat in the student quad, because we young radicals liked you, Lloyd. He was blowing the world open in places of the world that we weren't. and started, I love China, so I was studying Chinese. I went deeply into early Taoism, early Chan Buddhism, which was the grounding of what became Zen Buddhism. So I really related to those aspects of your talk. And very early was trying to syncretize between early Christianity, early Taoism, early Buddhism, and the Marxist-Leninist, Maoist, communistic background that I also had. I don't want to go through all these groups because it will take too much time. I studied in China in 80 to 81, which was still post-Maoist, and that was quite a profound experience as well. When in the late 70s, I spent 3.5 years on the domestic purposes benefit with twin babies. I lost my career, my starting career as a journalist, which my daughter has took up later. A lot of you have talked about my daughter, kia ora. So I'd studied and started work as a journalist, quaintly, as they say, fell pregnant, had twins. That experience on the DPB obviously had quite a big effect on where my life was going to go. In 1981, you'll see the photo there from my wedding to Bill. I'm very lucky to find a good man, and we had another 3 children, so I'm a mother of 5 as well, and I think being a mother or father is also, of course, a profound part of our lives. I really re-radicalised in 1981 with the Springbok tour just after I came back from China, and I'm sure some of you were involved with that. The heart of my political life started in 1983 when I was part of a group that set up the Auckland Unemployed Workers' Rights Centre. Some of you will remember this is just in the last years of Muldoon, and unemployment had just gone past 100,000 people. And it was a national disgrace. People really cared about unemployment then, like it was a shocking thing. And I see people from different parts of the country, you'll remember that. We called a public meeting in Kay Road in Auckland, and over 100 people came, such was the concern about unemployment. And from that, we set up this Unemployed Workers' Rights Centre. The only group that would give us a base was the Pitt Street Methodist Church. Kia ora, any Methodists or former Methodists? Because without the support of that local minister and subsequent ministers at that church, our group would never have started. The same night we set up the centre, the trade union, FOL-CTU in Auckland, set up a counter-unemployed group that would be controlled by the trade unions. You wouldn't believe it. So from day one, we were sectarian, so a union-controlled group, because they didn't want the unemployed getting out of hand, whereas we were church-backed in an alliance with church people. And I think that was the beginning of my and our group's willingness to be open to the role that Christians and people of other faiths could pay in the sort of radical political work that we were doing on the ground. Our kaupapa, right from the start, was this one, jobs and a living wage for all. That is that everyone in this country deserves the right to a decent job and education and training that will lead to work that they want to do. And whether in work or out of work, we all deserve enough money to live on. Now, that sounds simple, but when you go into the economics and social justice back of that, it's actually everything. And what we did was both individual casework advocacy at what was then Department of Social Welfare and Department of Labour, and collective advocacy, all the direct action on the streets, the lobbying, research, media work, and so on. And I never dreamt that I would spend 16 years of my life in the unemployed movement, but I did. It became, in a way, the core work of my life. During the life of that group, by the late 1980s, we set up a group called New Vision, which became a slightly more formal way to bring the radical left Christians who were part of our group and supporting our work, and what we always used to call ourselves heathens. I was interested in your use of the word heathen too, because that's what we used, those of us who did not come from any church background, we used to call ourselves the heathens as a kind of shorthand. But the Christians, of course, were not, they weren't from any one church, but the majority were actually from the radical left of the Catholic Church, very much from a liberation theology background. So I can see why I haven't come across your strand, because I had so much to do with people that came out of Paulo Freire, great Catholic actors and thinkers in South America, the Philippines and other places, were more the roots of some of the people that we worked with. There were certainly Anglicans and other Protestants involved as well. And we used to meet regularly as part of the work of the Unemployed Rights Centre to deepen our thinking, not just about day-to-day work, but also very consciously, economically, politically, spiritually, even theologically, like to really get into the debates. Quite a few nuns and priests were part of the group, so they helped deepen that thinking too. And it was very effective, brought this tremendous synergy between the heathens and the Christians. And a lot of actions. I don't know if anyone was at our Love and Action, which in the early 90s was under when Jenny Shipley was Social Welfare Minister. The churches at that time, there was a massive rise in food banks, and we really hated the rise in food banks because we saw it as a way of compensating for the benefit cuts. And we thought that the church leadership was really complicit in this because they were just boasting away about how many food banks they had and how many people they were helping with food, where we were saying, no, reverse the benefit cuts, but give people jobs, give people enough to live on, don't do it by charity. The church leaders of Auckland got together and organised this festive event at the Aotea Centre in Auckland, invited the Minister, Jenny Shipley, to come, and to us it was like this peak contradiction. So we got together, our group, including the priests and nuns, came in their proper clothes, charged in. We did our usual thing of charging in and occupying the base where Shipley was going to speak, which caused great consternation, and we were physically thrown down the stairs by the cops. It was our usual, often our usual mode of action. But then, after having been thrown out, we performed with the priests and nuns leading us a liturgical ceremony around outside the centre, like to bring home, with a full liturgy and music, to bring home the contradiction and the evil of what we saw the churches, and this is across both Protestant and Catholic churches, the evil of what we saw them doing and basically supporting what Jenny Shipley and her government were doing to unemployed people and beneficiaries. As a result of that, it created quite a lot of havoc in church circles. And one of the priests and I were invited to this very high-level meeting of church leaders to explain ourselves. Which, of course, was harder for Peter Healy, if anyone knows him, harder for Peter than for me, because I wasn't attached. That's just to give you one little idea of where that interface, there were many other interfaces, but of where that interface went in terms of actions. But it wasn't just in the street actions and that kind of activity. It was also the Christians often had really strong skills in creative and cultural work and brought music and drama and theatre and skills in that to help lead us, and that was really valuable in our work as well. They also helped deepen our thinking about how to set up and having the courage to set up a whole range of new organisations, not just this Unemployed Workers' Rights Centre, but going past that, and I'll just talk about a few of them. Has anyone here heard of the Auckland People's Centres? Not many. Wellington People's Centre, that was set up as a result. Kia ora, not really. A few of you, yeah, the Thornleys would know. In 1989, the Unemployed Workers' Rights Centre, gradually we worked together for about a year and gradually formed this idea of the People's Centre, of having places which belong to the people where anyone could join them for $10 a month per family and get these services. This is how it evolved. It didn't all happen at once, but absolutely free medical care. And we always said we want this medical care at the same level as people in Remuera. We're here for anybody. Once we had a medical service established, everyone said, where's the dentist? Because everyone here knows the state of that. So gradually, with the help of a very good dentist, we set up our own dental services. We had to charge for them, but we charged as little as possible. We continued with our beneficiary advocacy. We had Christian chaplains. We had a small business and self-employment support unit, our own education programs, free haircuts. But at the same time, we kept our Unemployed Workers' Rights Centre, which was the political and educational wing, going. So there was a synergy between the services wing and the political wing. We were not a charity. The People's Centre was owned and run by its members. The Unemployed Rights Centre sat alongside it, and we had a relationship like this that meant that we could stay independent from the government because the People's Centre provided us with a stream of income that enabled the unemployed work to keep going. And we, in turn, the skills of our group helped keep the People's Centres going. So it was a very mutual relationship. In fact, after we closed the Unemployed Rights Centre in 1999, there were three Auckland People's Centres by then, in Auckland Central, Manurewa and Mangere in South Auckland. What happened was the People's Centre slowly declined without the political activist leadership that we provided. It was quite a sad story. Another initiative that we were very much part of was something called Building Our Own Future. And this is where my life touched John Thornley's. In 1993 to 1994, the Conference of Churches of Aotearoa, CCANZ, was anyone ever part of CCANZ? It was, as you can see, a church-led project that they at the beginning had totally... They hadn't considered outside the churches, really. But some of us in the unions and community fought back inside the church processes and said, look, if you're talking about building our own future, it can't just be done from inside church groups. Yeah, what about those of us, like us building the People Centre on the ground and a whole lot of other people? What about including us in building our own future together? Those church leaders listened and they gave some of the money to Unemployed Rights Centre and to a union group to jointly run a national project in which we held a series of regional people's assemblies around the country. We held a number of sectoral meetings around the country in these areas you see here, community economic development, groups with students and young people, unemployed and beneficiary, radical church people, community housing initiatives, and unions, a whole lot of others. It was a very, very fertile time, and from it we created a national people's charter, like a manifesto, really, of our vision for how Aotearoa could be, a truly transformed Aotearoa. And that People's Charter is still available, and I've given references here. I think it's online on the web as well, if you want to track that down. I still think it's a very good collective statement of the sort of politics and place that I believe in which all of us across between church and heathens at that time, I mean, a lot of us would still stand by it, even though some of the language might feel a bit outdated. But not just about belief and vision, but also of the need that we commit to taking action on this. It's not just about talking and thinking, it's also acting. Another organisation, this time that came out of the Building Our Own Future project, was this one, Kotahi Research and Education for Social Change Trust. A lot of us that had been activists in the movements and unions for a long time realised that in Aotearoa there was no place where we could pass on the skills and knowledge and experiences of us, the older generation. We had no school of our own. We had no educational place of our own. And also we had no papakāinga of our own. So from that impulse grew over a long period, starting with Building Our Own Future, the development of Kotahi Trust. This is still going strong up at Hōtio North near Wellsford. We're still going. I'm still very active in it and working with it, along with other friends. And we acquired land through a joint project between Bill and my family, our own family, and the Sisters of St. Joseph at Whanganui, which was an amazing process of this very, we were seen as radical communists, of course. Sitting down, we had to sit through a day of discernment with the entire order of the sisters. Can you imagine it? A whole full day of discernment, working out whether the sisters would actually come in on this project. We put all our resources, they put 50% in, and we jointly bought a 50-acre farm. And we lived there with a sister and a priest for some years. And from that farm, we let a hectare go, which became the land that Kotahi built on. So over the years since 1999, we've worked in a lot of sectors right across the movements across the country, all the ones up there and others, including unions, unemployed and beneficiaries, a lot of the sectors that you saw in the Building Our Own Future project, and church people or former church people are still very much part of the work of Kotahi. Some of you will recognise Leonard Cohen here, maybe. They sentenced me to 20 years of boredom trying to change the system from within. It was actually 10 years for me, and it wasn't boring. This was extraordinary, going from being a very radical street activist, arrested probably more times than most activists in this country, been in brief times in jail, often beaten up by police, going from that world to the one of Parliament. Rod Donald, who many of you will remember, a terrible loss to our country and to the Green Party, recruited me to the Green Party in 1998, and I'd never dreamt I'd become an MP, but at that time, we felt the Green Party offered a huge amount of hope for this country, with its kaupapa of commitment to social and ecological justice. And by that stage, to be frank, I'd got very sick of being this person that everyone saw as a radical agitator, always in fights with the police, and that, you know, that wasn't my life. My life was in building organisations and working with people to change this country. But people had that image of me, and I was sick of being, oh, Sue's good, that's good, you're over there, while we're here earning lots of money, having great jobs and a great life. Oh, bugger it, you know, I'd like to go in and try and change it seriously. My goal was to become a Minister of Social Development or a Minister of Housing and really try and make change government level and use all that experience and life I'd had at grassroots and take that into Parliament. Now, you'll know the sad story, at least the New Zealanders here will know the sad story, that during my 10 years there, the Greens never got near a governing role. I did manage to get 3 private members' bills through in one term of Parliament, which is the record of any MP, I think, still is. And the biggest one, of course, was the one around Section 59 and the Crimes Act, which stopped a legal assault on children. But other things as well. And I guess the theme my whole time in Parliament was to try and give voice to children, to unemployed and beneficiaries, low-paid workers, migrants, homeless, the same people covering from mental health and addiction, the same areas that I've been working with out in the community. I took that and did my best. In 2009, I lost a co-leadership struggle with Materia Ture, which looking back, it seems quite... I can have a lot of reflections on that now. Why did I ever stand against her? I was doomed from the start, but I felt I did have something potentially to offer the party. The party didn't want it. Many of the party members at that time even thought that my work on Section 59 with children thought that was too radical because of the response to it. And so having felt... the party had shifted under me, like to become more conservative. I then just felt that that wasn't my place to stand anymore, and I left. In 2010, I had a big gap in my life at this point. I was approached by some community and church leaders in Auckland to set up an activist and advocacy beneficiary and unemployed group again. I never dreamt I would undertake that work ever again, because it's very tough. But there was this huge gap that the absence of the Unemployed Workers' Rights Centre and the People's Centres had left. And there was also no fighting unemployed groups left in the country. At the same time, we had a new national government that was starting to bring in dreadful welfare reforms. They persuaded me, and I worked with a whole lot of other people to set up this new group, Auckland Action Against Poverty. Most of them of a younger generation, but a few of us from the older generation. And again, this group, AAAP, you might hear of us from time to time, is very vibrant, very active. The need that we're trying to meet with individual casework is beyond belief in Auckland. We have advocates going out to Clendon, which is in the heart of Manurau, a very, very poor district, every Friday. The people start queuing to get our help at 12 o'clock the night before. And that's how, by 8 o'clock or 8:30, when our advocates arrive, the queue, we can only, between us and Working Income at Clendon, only 65 people or families can be helped in one day. Every Friday this happens. That's just a tiny snapshot of what it's like in Auckland right now. Auckland Action Against Poverty was set up. We set it up as a traditional unemployed beneficiary group. Didn't think we'd ever get into housing. But because the housing crisis in Auckland is so severe and the homelessness of people of all sorts that AAAP deals with, we've ended up being very active on the housing and homelessness issues as well, because it's so deep and so bad. And our work around the motels was one of the reasons of exposing people's Working Income, just sending people off to the park for the night with their children, with their disabled people, everything. Forcing Working Income to, through media exposure, it forced them to start putting people into motels. I mean, that's just one, yeah. Other groups helped with that, but we were at the front of that one. And AAAP's... at the same time as working with Auckland Action Against Poverty and Kotari, for 3 years, I took time out to reflect and research. Lucky enough to have Marilyn Waring at AUT as a supervisor to do a thesis. I won't go into it here. But this was really a chance to reflect and look at the state of the left, my part of the political world in Aotearoa, at that time. And I interviewed 51 people across all parts of the left for that thesis. The thesis was around the topic why we've never had a left think tank, a major left think tank in this country. We've had right-wing ones and still do, but we've never had a major left-wing think tank. And that seemed to be a huge gap that needed filling. So I looked at the key thing I was investigating, and what I found, it was strongly supported right across the left, and there were many possibilities. But despite the enthusiasm of some for the concept of a pan-left think tank, that's one that would span from Labour right across Green, ecological left through to the radical left. I don't think there's any way that could ever happen because the ideology and kaupapa of the different parts of the left are so different. But there's room for us all to do it, anyone to do it if they want to. Looking at the state of the left itself, for many of us there was no party. For a while the Mana Party was a hope. I joined the Mana Party in 2011 when Hune Harawira and Annette Sykes set it up, because they invited me and other radical left Pākehā to come in, and it was the first time that we'd had the chance to be part of a Māori radical left party. But I think Kiwis here will know what happened. From my point of view, a total disaster when Mana lost its mana by joining up with Kim.com, the criminal German multi-billionaire, who stood in our Mana AGM and said, "I believe the economic way forward is to have more foreign investment in this country." How could Mana support that? So that was my last party. Sad story there. So, but basically out of that whole thesis, underpinning theme, those of us who identify as any part of the left need more times and spaces to think. And so you can see one of the reasons I did accept the invitation here today is because I see what you're doing as part of that thinking. And the more that we think across our sectarian lines, whether it's within the left politically or whether it's across theological lines, the more we can think and talk together across those lines, the better our hope is for transformation. So what I'm doing now, after I finished my thesis of 2014, I got a 2 days after finishing, after submitting, anyone that's done a PhD will know what this feels like, 2 days after finishing, I started work as a lecturer, full-time lecturer at Unitech, teaching social work, social practice. That was incredible, like suddenly having to write the curriculum, be a lecturer. And I was there for nearly a year, but by the end of that year, I realised, gee, what do I really want to do? What I really wanted to do was to set up a left-wing think tank. So I left very stupidly now, I think, but once again, I tried. I left and with other people started the process of setting up yet another new organisation. There is no time to go into it here, but sadly, in July this year, I left that project. It's still going in a very diminished way, and I just don't have time to talk about that, but it was another. We keep learning. I often think of it as rehearsing. We make the path by walking it. We keep trying to set up just to make change. We have huge failures at times, but from those failures we keep learning. So there is still no radical left think tank here, except in a very small way. I'm still involved in Kotahi Trust, very active with that, and with AAAP. I continue to do some PhD supervision and work at AUT in a small way. But I'm really open, I feel in quite an open or liminal space here at the moment, looking for what comes next. I think people ask me, what's your next big project, Sue? I don't know the answer to that. I might have enough juice and time left for at least one. And I don't know what it'll be. From all this learning theory experience, and I'm sure many of you will have heard this before, but I believe that there are three main ways of creating change for the better in our world. One is from outside the system, all the rock throwing, the protests, the battering at the gates of power, the exposing of the evils of what the elite does to us. Then there's the long march inside, whether it's parliament, whether it's inside a church, whether it's inside the council, wherever it might be, public service. And then the third way is building our own organisations and what some of us see as a rotten system. And building the People Centre, building Kotahi Trust, those are examples of us trying building our own places and spaces and trying to make a new road. And there are many such initiatives around the country. This UniMEC here that I've got, you might not have heard of it. It's an organisation I've done a bit of work with lately, which is a union of migrant workers, because, of course, in Auckland and elsewhere, the exploitation of migrant workers is extreme in some cases, and Clay knows all about that. I've just finished a research project looking at the conditions of Filipino migrant dairy farm workers. That was my main work with them, in case you're interested in that sector. And working to make change, and this will... Because I've worked with some church people a lot, I came to realise quite early on that the kind of commitment that I have is a form of vocation, that in some ways is not all that different to that my friends that had been or are priests and nuns had. So it comes from very deep inside, and it was a commitment that I consciously made when I was about 16, when I was locked up in police cells, and I felt unjustly locked up. And I was... I was very young, and I'd just been fully strip searched by male cops, and thinking, do I want my life to be like this? I grew up white Pākehā, my father was a university professor, a scientist. I had all the options in the world ahead of me. I was locked up with ship Māori, what used to be called shippies. I think people will remember that. Whose side am I on in this? And so a long cold, sad night in the cell, but I always go back to that and think that's when I really decided I'm going to put my life with the Māori ship girls and not with the elite place that I had the opportunity to be part of, that I was lucky and privileged enough to be born into. And I think that's the same sort of vocation that some people from Christian and other faith backgrounds come from. And so in a nutshell, my belief, just to nutshell it, is this: a commitment to economic, social and ecological justice grounded into Te Reti or Waitangi. And I believe that we need to move, that we both must oppose the excesses of capitalism and what it's doing to our country and to the world. and also move beyond it in as most democratic and humane a way as we can. It's also got internationalist groundings that we can't just act in our own country. We have to be aware of what's happening elsewhere. And really great to see our new government doubling the refugee quota, just for example. But behind this, acting on these commitments, not just talking about them. Another key thing in all this has always been, if I'm unsure, if the group I'm in is unsure about where we go next or what side we take, it's always asking this question: at which point in these circumstances, whose side am I or is this group on? Now that can need quite a lot of analysis, but how can we affect structural change? How can we expose what's really causing these social ills? And what can we really do about it now without being tempted into what I always call magical thinking, like the short solution, okay, this is wrong, there's a shortcut to it. But actually thinking deeply enough to say, how can we affect change from where we are in our small, under-resourced, poverty-stricken group? What can we do at this point? And whose side are we on in that? Now, I've been surprised there hasn't been more talk about transformation here, but of course this conference is grounded in, starts from the base of Luther's Reformation. But I work with the word transformation a lot because I think that we really need to give the hope and vision of what transformation applies, that in a really deep way we can go beyond what exists and even conceive of going beyond in a way that transforms rather than just reforms. But in some of the green world that I've been part of, there's some questions around the use of the word transformation. I mean, one reason to use it is that politics can be really depressing. We do have neoliberal capitalism triumphant. I've heard talk here about the fact of climate change and resource depletion. None of us can afford to ignore that. And as a country, we should be doing a lot more, and I hope we'll be. We do actually have deepening inequality here every day, with much of the population completely unaware of what life is like for the people who have nothing. We have a cycle of governments, and I hate to say this right now, but I'm quite wary about what's going to happen really in terms of serious change, for example, to welfare and housing, because Labor in the 2000s was part of this cycle of penalising the poor. In many ways, they laid the ground for Nationals' welfare reforms. I'm hoping that this new government will do better than that, but we'll see. There's also been a failure of the Pākehā or Tauiwi left to adequately take on the challenge from Māori of moving to a society that's truly based or treaty-based. And that's another challenge that people in the groups I'm with that we constantly face and try to pick up, but there's so much work that needs to be done. Oh yeah, that was just quickly about the election result. I didn't want to dwell on this. It is a time of hope for people, but in our groups also deep caution, because we've seen it all before. And one of the dangers of a Labor Green New Zealand First government, or a government that's to the left, is that a lot of the activism on the ground and the organisation building and trade unions and grassroots community actually goes out the window, because a lot of the key people can get jobs and funding. People like me and others can get tempted by salaries or positions, and it takes out the leadership, and groups can crumble and fail during that period. So it's a real danger, and I myself have to watch out for that danger. I'm not immune. Look at me. I went to Parliament for 10 years. I'm no angel. Because we need that activity outside Parliament to put the pressure on the parties that are in there. But we need that change outside and inside. So going back to transformation, as I'm sure everyone here knows, it can be very personal, it can be spiritual, it can be political and other things. And it doesn't necessarily, I think as you were pointing out, it doesn't necessarily have to be at any political point on the political spectrum. It can be anywhere from far right to far left when you talk about political transformation. But from a left perspective, some of the dangers I've seen in the kind of green left world that I've come from lately, some of the questions and debates I've been in that world have been, if we change ourselves by achieving higher consciousness, do we actually change the world? Because I've been in fearsome arguments with people from the Coromandel who say, oh, Sue, you've got it wrong, because if we all achieve, if we go for the Buddhist, I think of it as Buddhist goal, the Buddhist goal of achieving consciousness now, like spend our lives in meditation and transformation in that way, then the whole world will be transformed. I don't accept that, but boy, we have big arguments on that. To me, unless we, yes, to personal transformation and higher consciousness, but if we don't also act, nothing will change for that Pacific Island family down the road who has nowhere to live and is sleeping in the park tonight. If we recycle, if we garden, if we bike, we do all these wonderful ecologically just things, will injustice end? And if we make our neighbourhood or town perfect, what will change? If we make, sorry to anyone from Matakana, north of Auckland, beautiful place, very slow food movement, vineyards, cafes, market, they've got lots of beautiful green things going on there, beautiful place to live. But how many of the people in Matakana, sorry to Matakana people, but how many of those people are actually acting or supporting, even supporting groups like ours that are trying to make structural change, or their local groups, you know, who are working with people in poverty, or groups that are working to change this country in a real way? Because you can put up the barriers and make a beautiful place to live for yourself and your family and your friends. This is the old, you know, some hippies went that way. But is that enough? So structural change is essential. And I love this banner from the Paris Climate Justice March. I think this was last year. A big banner there, you might not be able to see it, but it says, change the system, not the planet. That's our job. And we need our own organisations to build our counterpower to the power we're up against. So that's why I'm here talking about making it real for anyone that's got an interest. And what I'm saying, unless we identify the true nature of the situation we're in every respect, analyse it, understand it, have the courage and take even a little bit of time to confront it or support others who are, unless we do create our own stories, our plays, our songs, our art, our visions of how a better future could be, so that we, in a collective way, this build new stories, new songs, new plays, that helps us to envision a new possibility. And unless we actively resist, nothing will change in this potentially dreadful journey that the planet and people are on. And of course, all that creative side of it can give us, and the solidarity of it gives us hope as well. And just on Sunday, funnily enough, before I came down here, I spent Sunday rehearsing and acting, being part of a play about the Russian Revolution. And I think for those of us, the cast, this is up in Auckland, the cast was a mix of, it was a play written by Dean Parker, who's quite a well-known playwright up there. And the cast, he had these really top-line New Zealand actors in it, and then a few of us from the street. And it was quite an amazing mixture of non-professional and professional, but sharing this story about the Russian Revolution. Much to Dean's surprise, the venue was absolutely packed. Like, people couldn't get in. So many people wanted to come. And I just think it's the power of storytelling and drama, and we need to use it a lot more. So I'd never lose the opportunity for presenting some actual challenges to the government. And this is just from where I sit on the political spectrum, and if any of you that were where my key interests have been, but of course there are many other places, you name it, across the system. Overturn National's welfare reforms. This question of the talk around child poverty, we actually have to talk about adult poverty, not just child poverty. It's so dangerous and it happens everywhere. And Child Poverty Action Group is one of my favourite groups. They've done a tremendous job and they continue to do one. But of course, governments and parties pick that up and they love children. But really, why is that child living in poverty? It's because of adult poverty. Some of you will have heard this mantra of social investment. Some of you, it's an ideology that they've deliberately permeated our welfare system and our public service. It's extremely dangerous because it reduces human beings to units of monetary value. That's all we are, not humans. And until I see this government actually get rid of, they've actually set up a small government department for social investment. And until that's gone, I will not trust this government an inch. We need to roll back, and this is a job many of us can be part of, rolling back the capture of the community sector by government and private sector, which has been going on for a long time. We need the government to deal seriously with the housing crisis everywhere, not just in Auckland. We need to, from the radical left Pākehā, we need to pick up seriously the challenges that people from Māori side confront us with all the time. And how, as I was saying before, how do we keep our own groups going when we do have a Labour-led government? It's a day-to-day challenge for us. So finally, just a few words about going beyond Reformation. It's, for me, it's about going beyond what we know or can conceive of now. That, and that's where that art, the art side of it is so important. Moving beyond individual ethical decisions and market solutions, and actually conceiving that our politics doesn't have to stay this way. Just because we have these parties in Parliament, we don't have to stick with that. So I still hold a dream of being part of a political party that is really on the kaupapa that I believe in, with no disrespect to people from other parties. And it may be many parties, but the future will be different and we create our own future. We need more and better leadership across age groups, inside and outside Parliament, and the kind of leadership that enables other people to become leaders too, not hierarchical, top-down leadership or weak leadership or leadership that hides itself but takes real totalitarian power. And I can tell you on the left there's a lot of that. We need to transcend. A lot of my life has been in a way, I mean, coming here makes me reflect on this, that actually so much of my life has been about trying to transcend both sectarian boundaries on the political left and between spiritual and religious people. I come from a very different place than you because I wasn't brought up Christian, but whichever place we come from, working to transcend those boundaries, where we find common cause, I think there will always be so much potential in that. And it's up to each of us to act, and not act alone, but to act with other people. One of the saddest things I've noticed in my life over and again, whether I'm working in Parliament or in a group on the ground, is the number of communications you get. It used to be very long handwritten letters, often from Pākehā, older Pākehā men, saying, I am very angry about this, and they'd write a long letter about what they're angry about it, and I want you to do something about it. And nothing makes me angry, actually. It's one of the... Whereas anyone that talks or writes that, like, you care, you're passionate about, you're angry about, please join with other people in your community and do something about it. Don't lay it all on me, works other humans around you. I'm not going to carry the weight of the country's anger. People try and make me do that. It's up to each of us to act, but know that we have to act with others and be willing to act respectfully with others, not just alone. And we need to be brave and full of hope. Wherever we are. So finally, some questions that I'm offering for consideration. From your point of view, what would a transformed Aotearoa look like for you? Can the practice and discussions like you're having here of spirituality and religion, can that be a substitute for political action of any sort, even very small action? Is working to end inequality and structure and its causes here a spiritual or religious issue which you could engage in? And do you have any ideas about steps forward for engagement and action? So thank you for inviting me to be here this week. Without the kind of hope tempered by realism and imbued by faith that another better world is possible, however we define and encompass that faith, any of our attempts at transformation and a future which embraces life itself will fail. Kia ora koutou.